Veteran producer Linda Obst shares an incisive, smart, and funny look at the film industry in her new book, Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. Obst was an editor for the New York Times Magazine before entering the film industry. She's produced more than 16 feature films, including How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, Contact, The Fisher King, Adventures in Babysitting, Hope Floats, and two films with Nora Ephron, Sleepless in Seattle, and This Is My Life. She is now producing television as well. She speaks from the front lines, combining her experiences with insights from the brightest minds in the business. Again, the title of the book is Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business, and it's a pleasure to welcome Linda Obst to the program. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So how do you define the new abnormal?
Well, the new abnormal is is the period in which we have more or less a pure diet of these blockbuster tentpole sequels and reboots, as opposed to and sort of giant big budget movies, as opposed to just having them in the summer and the winter and maybe spring break like we used to 20 years ago, 30 years ago when I first started. And I tried to figure out why that was, and that's what the book is all about, trying to figure out when it turned into a period in which the movie, the original movie, started feeling like an endangered species.
You point out very early on in the book that under this new abnormal, films such as Field of Dreams and Forrest Gump and Driving Miss Daisy and The Graduate and The Big Chill would not be made unless they were small independent films.
That's exactly right. Those are all films that were giant hits in the old abnormal that would have an incredibly hard time getting made today. And I was just stumped by that fact when I realized it in the middle of my tenure at Paramount about 7 years ago. So I went on an expedition talking to the smartest people I know to try to figure out why that was. And I figured out that the real reason is that movies now are being made for the international market as opposed to the domestic market as they were in my day when I first came into the business. It's still my day in the sense that I'm still making movies, but now I have to take into consideration the fact that most of our profits in the movie business are coming from international and not coming from the domestic market anymore. It was 20% of the international market made up our revenues when I first began, and 80% were the domestic market, UK and the United States and Canada. Now it's flipped on its head, and it's 20% from the United States and Canada, and 80% from abroad.
Has the audience changed at all? In the sense of, would we still want to see those films and hold on to that old abnormal, or is it the industry that is changing it for us?
Well, it's interesting. In the beginning of the new abnormal, we were also making movies for teen boys. Teen boys were the most reliable market for the movie industry because they went to the movies in droves to get out of the house with one another on the first weekend when the studios made the most money. So the domestic market, most reliable audience, and the international market were very similar, and that made it very easy for the industry to make its most gigantic hits. Blockbusters that all cost upwards of, you know, almost $200 million, between $150 million and $250 million. But now I think the audience is beginning to fatigue, the domestic audience is beginning to fatigue of a pure diet of blockbusters and sequels and reboots, as you can see by the second half of this summer. Obviously, the whole world, including us, loves a successful blockbuster, The Avengers, The Dark Knight. When they're great, we love them. And the beginning of the summer was incredibly successful. But the audience is sophisticating, and it is weary of repetitive, redundant, overwrought spectacles that have no heart and have no reason to be. How many times can you see the same buildings and cities being blown up, you know? Mm. So I think it is beginning to hunger for comedy. It's beginning to hunger for the drama it's getting on television. It's beginning to hunger for fresher material that's not just based on special effects that the overseas market loves.
So when you hear things like just this past weekend with Wolverine, where the film was number one in the box office but didn't do nearly as well as it was expected to do.
Right.
So is that the death knell, or can that still, because of an audience in China and Russia, can that still make money?
It can still make money precisely because of what I first said, that the majority, the big bulk of the revenues are now coming from the new emerging markets and the other reliable international markets, like in Brazil and South Korea and all over the world. Our movies are playing incredibly well, so it will make up its disappointing weekend and its disappointing gross domestically with its performance overseas. But, for example, Pacific Rim, which came out a few weeks ago, which cost an enormous amount of money to make and was an original tentpole, the question of whether there will be a sequel based on that and it will become a franchise, which is the point of these big endeavors. You don't spend $250 million unless you're creating an enterprise, right? A business.
Mm.
Whether there will be a sequel on that is now entirely dependent on its performance overseas. Can it make up it'll barely make $100 million here. If it does, it's now, in its fourth week, only at $84 million by how much it earns overseas. That is a real question. So I think the death knell is a very strong word because it's a very resilient business.
Mm.
And it did so well in the beginning of the summer that, it still, all in all, had a good summer. But some of these movies were very, very costly flops. And I think it's going to make the studios much more discerning in terms of which movies it's going to make into tentpoles and perhaps make room for more movies like The Heat, more movies like more comedies and smaller original films, which is what, my book is a plea for.
What is fascinating about that is that you take Bridesmaids for an example. Here's a film that went on, became a huge hit. The Heat is another big hit this summer. But part of the problem is that they're not as international friendly because they're comedies and they're jokes, and that doesn't always play as well elsewhere.
Well, the paradox is that Bridesmaids, when it was first greenlit by Universal, looked to be a disaster overseas. There were four unknown television stars, and they were women, which is about as unfriendly as you can get to the international market, which is why movies like that don't get greenlit. But ironically, it performed, way overperformed domestically, and they opened it overseas, and it did really, really well. It actually made over $100 million, $120 million overseas, I think even more than that. So now Melissa McCarthy is a big star overseas. And it could be a sequel if Kristen Wiig wanted it to be. And now we've created a brand new international star out of someone who was unknown overseas right before, which is a very healthy cycle for the movie business because someone had the gut to green light that movie in the first place and the courage, which is what it takes to keep cycling the business with healthy new blood. Someone first needs the gut to greenlight a $20 million movie in the first place. And then you create new stars like Melissa McCarthy, even women stars, who then can go on to make The Heat, which will do well internationally. Because as it turns out, even though comedy doesn't do as well, because comedy, every country has its own sense of humor, as the great head of Fox said to me, slipping on a banana peel is funny in every culture. Broad comedy does perform well, and The First Hangover did really well overseas too, which is why it was sequelized. So it's possible to break the mold if someone has the original courage to greenlight the first talented script, and that was because of Judd Apatow, of course.
Linda Obst is our guest. The name of the book is Sleepless in Hollywood: Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. You take a film like World War Z with Brad Pitt. It's based on a fairly successful novel. It has a huge budget and ultimately flops. So is that, does that make, even if the international sales are good, isn't what happens in this country a predictor of what can happen internationally?
Well, I will have to take issue with World War Z being a flop. It actually worked domestically. It was predicted to be a flop because it was so expensive and the production kind of had major problems. But it turns out that the IP, the intellectual property, or what we used to call a book, that it was based on, and the combination of that book and zombies with Brad Pitt ended up working. Maybe it didn't make as much money as some gigantic tentpoles like The Avengers or something, which has an even more famous book, you know, or IP, the comic book of The Avengers, brings in even more people. But it wasn't one of the big flops of the summer, for sure. It will more than break even. But the question is, yes, does the domestic, your question is a great one, does the domestic audience predict the success of the movie worldwide? If it completely flops in the U.S. and it's an original, it has a hard time getting a good release. If it doesn't break $100 million, it won't get a release abroad, unless it's a sequel or a reboot with such awareness that the it exists already overseas. To a certain extent, it will predict some portion of the reception overseas. But the appetites are slightly different. They just love our special effects. They're not tired of 3D like we are. That's one of the biggest differences in the two markets. They just can't get enough of 3D and huge explosions. They're like in some countries, fanboys times 50. But I think the reason is that their more culturally sophisticated tastes are being met by their local productions. So what they want from us is what we do better than anybody else. They don't want nuanced dramas that they have to loop, right?
Mm.
They can see nuanced dramas in their own tongue. They don't want complicated romances. They can get that in their own tongue from their own language, from their own filmmakers. And more as those emerging markets sophisticate, particularly in China, their own filmmakers are making billion-dollar movies of their own that are going to crowd out the American product. And that's going to have an interesting consequence, too, possibly making the domestic market more important again.
Okay, so we disagreed on, not disagreed, but you took issue with World War Z being a flop. Lone Ranger, a flop?
A flop.
Okay. All right. And do we know why?
Well, I have my theories, but I think pretty much everybody agrees that the property was not a great bet. And I think underneath, they weren't really betting on the Lone Ranger. They were betting on the fact that it was a famous title, but not all famous titles have the same value. It has pre-awareness, but to whom, right?
Right.
It's a very old radio show, and not a lot of young people care about it, and the old guys that do are not blockbuster goers. And then I think they were really betting on Johnny Depp and Gore Verbinski and Jerry Bruckheimer, who gave you Pirates of the Caribbean. But it wasn't Pirates of the Caribbean 7, right? It was The Lone Ranger.
Mm.
So there was a confusion on what was getting greenlit, right? And who is it for? Was it for the kids who love Westerns? It was too violent to be for kids. And at the same time, if this combination is so great in international, they hate Westerns internationally. It's a famous thing I talk about in my book, that dust doesn't travel. And by dust, we mean anything with a cowboy hat, horses that kick up dust, famously doesn't travel. My movie Hope Floats had to be sold without the cowboy hat on Harry Connick. We had to pretend it was not set in Texas. So I think it was a flop. For me, I just knew it was a flop the second I saw Johnny Depp in that silly costume.
Even though we're used to Johnny Depp being in silly costumes, right?
Yeah, but this one wasn't based on Keith Richards, right? It wasn't a cool, silly costume.
When you look at films that are from these huge franchises, I mean, and reboots, you mentioned, Superman came out, Man of Steel came out this year, and it seems to be the jury's still out on that film. I mean, obviously, the big question is, what do they do with the franchise next? There's talk of mixing of the characters.
Yeah.
Is that, I don't know, is that considered a sequel? Is that considered a success then?
Man of Steel?
Yes.
Oh, I think Man of Steel is considered a success. And I think they were very lucky to get Christopher Nolan to be part of the marketing mix. It very much had his look. Do you know that sort of dark, cool, not silly superhero look?
Right.
And I think that Superman had been denuded in some way, you know? And he got his testosterone back in this iteration, graphically anyway. And I think it was well cast. Warner Brothers has this DC catalog, and it has to wring the most possible value out of that, because in this era of the new abnormal, the IP is king, the IP being the intellectual property, and there are only two classic comic book catalogs, Marvel and DC. The other ones are all very dicey and dubious, do you know? They have they have second-tier and newer characters.
Right.
So what these two studios do with these characters, obviously the Avengers model is extremely attractive, right? So mixing and matching these comic book heroes is a huge part of being the marketing studio head of today, sadly or happily, depending on your perspective.
So, two questions as we round out our conversation. What does this mean? And I'll get to what this means for the audience in a moment. But what does it mean for actors? If you were an actor like Henry Cavill and starring as Superman, do you want to have that franchise? I mean, do you want to wear those tights again?
Well, that's a question better asked to Henry Cavill, who began as a Shakespearean actor. But I think the truth of the matter is, you know, I know George Clooney fairly well, and he played Batman once, and
right. He
hated it. But that was with a different director, right, who gave it a less cool feel. So I think it really depends on how the character is treated by the director. What it ultimately does do as a, not as an actor, but as a choice giver, is it, if you're in a successful franchise, between franchises, you're able to finance independent movies on your own success overseas in various markets. So between your green lights, you're able to do a great number of different kinds of movies based on your success. On the other hand, and look at what Hugh Jackman does. That's a great example. He's created a very varied, an extremely varied career based on, you know, his playing Wolverine, because it gives him such power. And on the other hand, some actors have been limited by the amount of time it takes to play a franchise and by being typecast by it. So it really depends on your age and your maturity and how you're able to leverage that role and how much fun you're able to have with it.
So what does it mean for movie lovers? What does it mean for us, those of us who enjoy seeing the drama and you know, want that film in our own tongue, as you put it earlier?
But we really have to speak with our feet, with our attendance. We have to vote with our feet. And when there's a special movie that is really different, like Silver Linings Playbook was, like The King's speech was, we have to go, and we have to go on the first weekend. And women have to do this if they want to see movies for them. And if the studios see are not going to bad tentpoles and are going to original movies, just the way avid fanboys do for their movies, it's a very, very responsive studio system. They'll still be making the movies they have to make in order to make a profit. It is the movie business, not movie, as my first boss pointed out to me pointedly. But they do want the domestic audience and need the domestic audience and spend most of their marketing money or all of their marketing money just to this, to us, to the American audience. So if we really care about movies, we should show it. We need to show it, and not through home entertainment, you know? We have to go to the movie theater, even if we're over 40 and 34, where they think we don't go to the movie theaters, and especially women, and fight for the original movie, fight for the fresh movie by insisting that we make more with the fewer, you know, if the studios choose to make one less blockbuster, let them make three more small, good movies.
The name of the book, Sleepless in Hollywood, Tales from the New Abnormal in the Movie Business. The book is published by Simon and Schuster. Linda Obst, thank you so much for sharing with us this morning. I greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Sleepless in Hollywood, published by Simon and Schuster. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.